I'm Sonia Morton Firth, and you're watching The Sonia Morton Firth Show. Today, my guest is Ketan Mokwana. Ketan is a renowned international TEDx speaker, author, and mentor. He's a serial entrepreneur and has scaled and sold multiple businesses. His enterprise lab has employed 150,000 people in 21 countries. Ketan has a mission to disrupt economies, a vision, and a passion to inspire people all over the world. Ketan, thank you so much for being a guest on my show.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Ketan, you've got some amazing achievements, but what started you on your entrepreneurial journey? How did it all begin?
It's a really good question, because actually I didn't think that I had an entrepreneurial journey in me. I've always been a career geek. I wanted to, once I kind of dropped out of university and got into work, all I ever dreamt of is having a six-figure salary in a corporate job and, you know, three holidays a year and, you know, that kind of
stuff. The normal stuff, right?
Yeah. Until about 2008, when the recession came along, and like it did with a number of people, it bit them in the bum. I felt like I was the only one that was suffering. You know, job queues had gone from being 20 deep to almost 200,000 people deep. You've got to make some decisions. And begrudgingly, I decided to go self-employed because of necessity, because I had to make money and to keep, you know, the bills being paid and roof over our head and stuff as such. What was interesting about that time was as I started to embrace more into self-employment, not entrepreneurship, the whole thing about I could be my own boss, or I can go where I wanted to go, and I can work with whoever I want to work with, started to really
appeal, right?
Yeah, it kind of really started to draw me. And I think it was almost six months into self-employment that this tube light switched on in my head and said, you should give this a crack. And, you know, the rest is kind of history from there. I think I first started up in the business of money. I then went into the business of producing value. And now I'm in the business of producing value for value for value. So, you know, the whole Robert Kiyosaki model about going from self-employed to solopreneur to business owner to investor is very much the journey that I've gone through. And that's the early indicators. I think for me, I didn't see any, any challenge as something that was going to stop me. I thought challenges were put there, not to test me, but to also show me a way that maybe I have to pivot as a person and I have to pivot my business to be able to move on. So, yeah, that's the kind of thing that's happened earlier on. The early stages of getting into business is quite scary, it's quite daunting, but it's also quite exciting. And it's a situation of just being conscious and aware about what you're doing when you're doing it, and that you have to change over time.
And that first business that you had, did you go on to sell that business before you started?
Yeah, so I'll be honest with you, I didn't really know what I was doing even when I started the company. I think
education did it exist in those days for entrepreneurs?
Obviously coaching and mentoring and having all that kind of stuff wasn't as sexy as it is today. Or, you know, yes, you could go to an evening school and learn how to start up a business, but I didn't do any of that. I worked for so many years. I took all of my experiences and expertise that I had in other people's businesses, and I was just doing what I thought was the most right thing or common thing to do. And the whole part of growing this business is I didn't know what I was doing, whether it was right, wrong, or how it was going to take me. I was just doing, primarily because, as I say, I didn't make this decision. This decision was bestowed on me.
Yes.
So when I first started out, I didn't really know that the business was growing at an exponential rate, or why we were doing so well. And, you know, we were only doing common things that you should be doing: going out there, marketing, getting yourself known, networking, you know, consulting, empathy, onboarding, rather than trying to just pitch. Mm. And it only dawned upon me when that there was something potential when I had an offer rather than me going out to sell. So one of the things that you may come across, people that watch this show, if you are in business, there are, or thinking about going into business, they almost have the end in mind. They're always thinking, right, I'm going to build a massive business. I'm going to sell it to Google for $1 billion.
Exit, yeah.
When, how, what? If you focus too much on your end, you forget what's in front of you. And to be honest with you, I was very, very unconsciously incompetent to all of this.
Did you have a vision? Did you have a sort of a...
I am literally... Everything the rule book tells you, I wasn't. You know, oh, you got to have a plan, you got to have the structure. No, I fell into it because I lost my job. The only reason why I thought about taking someone else on into the business is because I'd bitten off more than I could chew. My mouth had written checks, my body couldn't cash. And I'm like, wow, I've got all this money potentially there, but who's going to do all the work? And these challenges, as I said earlier, were, I went looking and saying, right, this is going to stop me, because people think, right, that's it, I've messed up, I can't go any further. I'm like, well, okay, it didn't work this way, let me try something else, or let me, common sense says that I should do this. And it was only kind of 18 months into the business when we got an offer that I thought...
Was it James Khan at the time?
Yeah. So, well, the story behind that as well is quite interesting, because I knew of James, obviously, with him and Dragon's Den and all this kind of stuff. I reached out. I didn't have his email address, so... If you want a lesson in tenacity and persistence,
absolutely. Although I am quite persistent, but for our viewers, it would be.
Yeah, what I did is I sat there one weekend thinking about every single permutation of James Khan email that could possibly be available. Then I put them all into one big email, and the email was simple. It was, "You're in resourcing. I'm in outsourcing. We should do business." And that was it.
Lovely.
Now, it's one of those, literally, let me just spray gun this to as many JCs or James Khans or whatever it is. And to be honest, truth be told, Sonia, is I forgot about it. I forgot I'd done it, because you get busy doing other things.
Yeah.
And a couple of weeks later, I got an email back from the correct email address saying, "That's really interesting. I would like to learn more about what you mean. Would you like to come in and have a chat?" So I went over to see him. And then I explained to him, these are the kind of things that we're doing. And he goes, so James is a very unique character in the sense that he is a very clever man, but he's a very, very shrewd operator in this particular way. And I don't mean shrewd in a negative way. Yeah. He knew what was coming, but what he did is he coached me into this arena where he turned around and he goes, so why us two? And I said, well, look, I notice you're starting Hamilton Bradshaw Venture Partners. I think you've got something that could work in the way, in the sense of actually having external resources that are put together to allow you to exponentially grow the businesses that you are partnering or investing into. And he goes, show me what you mean. So we showed him a case study of one of the projects that we'd done. And that was it. All I got next was an invitation to the launch at RBS. I met him there again with Mark Britton from Google back then. And... again, 2 days after that that meet, we had an offer, and I'm like, what do I do? So I don't know. I got this kind of, the pit of my stomach feel was, maybe I've taken this business as far as I could and it can go into someone else's hands and they can do a better job. Maybe they see something in this that I don't. Or maybe this is luck, Lady Luck telling me that
it's time.
But there's only three ways James operates, okay? And the interesting thing is James and I actually had the pleasure of reworking together during the Startup Loans thing afterwards. So he was a chair, I was working on the project with Lord Jung, and then on to through a company that we made the national delivery partner. So we ended up working again together. And one of the distinct reasons to why we started to work, or we got to work again together, primarily is because I understood him as a person. I said, there are three ways that he will work with you, or he will work in this environment. He'll either look at what you do and he'll muscle you out of your market, which is what most people think happens when, and we get that as well. When we get people coming in and wanting to talk to us about their business ideas, or they want capital raising done for them, they're like, you must sign an NDA. You've got to swear that you'll never do this. And I'm like, I've not time to make plastic underwear, you know, yeah, whatever exactly. It is that you're pitching me.
So many people think that an idea is a business. And
exactly.
I come across it and I've worked with entrepreneurs, I've been one myself, and it's not. Nine times out of ten, people don't execute.
No.
You can have the greatest idea on the planet, but unless you execute, it's not going anywhere.
Exactly. Well, this is a great idea, a great kind of resulting factor of this. This was not an idea. This is just what I thought we needed to do at that point in the market. It wasn't a gap in the market or anything like this. None of these little connotations. The second way James works is he sees the value in you, and what he'll do is he'll absorb you and your business. So he's almost like, come in and work for me.
So he wanted you a CEO?
He'll want to be chairman, he'll want to run this, but it comes apart. That's the second way he'll work with you. Well, the third way, he's gonna come in, take what he wants of yours, and you go two separate ways. I would never have done, option one he could have come in and done, I wouldn't even known. Option two, maybe, but then I'm the kind of guy today that is never gonna be held ransom to any other person. I've become highly unemployable in this. Ironically, I wanted to be a career geek, now I can't go back to that. So it had to be option three, which was very much of, he took on what he wanted to do, and that gave me the space to move on and do what I did next.
And what did you do next? Because presumably you took that and thought, wow, this is amazing. My first business is a success, right? And it's...
Well, yeah, you can define success, because the honesty thing is, I don't know if it was a success or not. You see, sometimes I do sit back and think about it, and I think, what if I didn't sell it?
I mean, that's an important point, because I think a lot of people go into business just for the money or just to tick something.
Yeah.
And if I look at businesses that are successful, what do you think the real root of a successful business is?
I think it's the culture and the ethos that the business owner puts into it. And as I said earlier, over time you will pivot. Your priorities change, what you want in life changes, your family life changes, even your business values change.
And do you believe you have to have a passion for it?
No, not necessarily. I think passion can get you through the door, but nothing. It won't open the door for you. Passion works in two ways. Mm. It can energize you, and it can de-energize you. Think of human relationships. You know, people who are with people even though they're not good for them, because they just simply love them. They've got so much passion for them, they cannot leave them.
Yeah,
there are people out there that.
Infatuation relationships, yes.
And there are. There are people that are infatuated with business and the thought of what they're going to be able to get, and they're never going to get there, unfortunately, no matter how hard they try, because they're just not made for that. And I think the for me, the importance is pivot and change. All of them, all the leaders you look in the world, whether there's one of two things that have happened, either they have had an inner breakthrough that's changed them, or something's happened to them in their life that has to change them.
Okay.
And that's the pivot piece. And for me, boredom was a pivot now. So what, you know, we started back in 2008 with necessity.
Yes.
Okay. Now we've gone to boredom. And for me, if I don't have that click, I can't keep moving. Yes, I can carry on sustaining. But who wants to sustain in life? Well, you want to thrive.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
So I think that was the key to why I needed to get out of that business.
So something important happened in 2011 that took you down a completely different route. Tell me about that.
So for those of you who are watching this, probably don't remember or may remember that we had the riots here in the UK. So obviously the economic recession had its impact in 2008. The job market was very, very volatile. There were young people now leaving education, unable to secure work. You could have three generations vying for the same job. And this was having an impact on the country. We were going through a dark time, you know. And as I say, you know, sometimes you don't know that you're pivoting until something happens to you. And I was watching the news on TV at home, and I could see all this rioting and looting.
I can't remember, Clapham was...
It was horrendous. And do you know what? I started to read up a little bit more about it, and there were like young people dying protecting their petrol station businesses and Coventry and stuff like this. This is absurd. This is the UK. We don't do this kind of stuff over here, you know. I'm not discriminating any other areas. Yeah. We just don't do this. And I kept looking and thinking, and I was just observing, and I was absorbed by what was going on. I think on the surface, a lot of people look and blame young people. But it actually wasn't even started by young people. They were the front end of this. They got the brunt end of it.
Yes.
They were kind of disfigured through because they people call them neets, like not in education, employment and training. They call them missing millions. They called all this kind of stuff. They, you know, whether it is gangs and gang warfare right the way through to people young people just fed up. And after all this kind of collection of thoughts, I started to think that something has to happen. There have been many a time, Sonia, you know, you've walked down the street and there's been a piece of litter and you've walked along and you've seen it and you said to yourself, it's okay, someone else will pick it up. Mm-hmm. There have been times where you've picked it up and someone goes, oh, wow, at least someone's doing something about something. Yeah. And I always say to people, you know, for those of you who look and say, oh, someone should do something about that, well, aren't you a somebody, okay, or a someone?
Absolutely.
So while I'm still sitting there, pen and paper out, started scribbling away a few things. And overnight, I came up with a concept and an idea for an event for young people. I thought to myself, if we can get everyone in the room and start knocking their heads about, maybe we can look at this. Because the way I saw it is the world of work, the industry, was sport for choice because they could go, and they'll go for cheap labour that's very, very experienced. They're not going to take a young person out of college. Young people are saying there's not enough opportunities. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to challenge them to say that if we create that opportunity for you, would you jump up and take it? And we also wanted to show government that actually they're not spending their money the right way. Now, this coincided with this inner desire to start working with the future generation. So Enterprise Lab, my current company, was born in May 2011.
What do you think that inner desire was driven by?
The fact that I didn't finish school, as in college, university. I dropped out of university and I felt that, you know, we are getting to this stage where it's getting tougher and tougher out there. The grass isn't as greener as it is academically. Plus, I was frustrated to the fact that academia wasn't really preparing our future generations to go out there and actually thrive. So Enterprise Lab was born to bridge the gap between that. So in May, I started Enterprise Lab. In October, we had the idea for this project. In April, I got to meet David Cameron, the Prime Minister then. And it was an interesting journey to get to him. Interesting in the way.
I was going to say, did you try his name a few times before you got there?
I did look at this, and you know, I was calling people up on this idea. You know, I was calling corporates up first and saying, would you like to get people putting the phone down on me? Now I know, you know, I'm a nobody, and people resonate with this whole thing of who are you to be telling me of what I should or shouldn't be doing in this particular way. So I had to appear to a higher source, and God wasn't available that day.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, the thing is, like, yeah, exactly. I couldn't pick up the phone and say, all right, Dave, can you help us out? Or let me through the gates, you player, but can't do any of that kind of stuff. But I did know something. I knew people that knew people that knew people, you know, the whole 6 degrees of separation and all that kind of stuff. So I started to work through the network. I started to support a few people who got me across. And then between October and April, I got there. And even then, the day I was supposed to go to Downing Street, I met Sean Bailey, who's now standing to be London Mayor, Mayor of London. Met Sean, and Sean was the guy who I was pitching to. I thought I was pitching to David Cameron, and he goes, no, you're pitching to me. And then, after an hour of this whole furore going around, you've worked that hard to get there, I get told, thanks, give us some information, and we'll see what happens. It went on from there that, again, my mouth started writing checks my body couldn't cash, because that's where passion comes in.
Yeah.
I was so passionate then, I'm like, I'm not going to let this go, that just as I left that afternoon, I got invited back for the evening reception where I could meet the Prime Minister. came in, came back. I was a little bit nervous. I'd been sitting in an establishment that doesn't serve coffee but serves other beverages. Basically, I had like 6 pints while I was waiting. I'm just going to be
so
straight over.
So you're like, yeah, two sheets of the wind, a little bit inebriated.
I've forgotten my umbrella. It's absolutely cats and dogs out there. I walk in looking, feeling like a drunken rat into Downing Street, come into this room. You've got Facebook, Shell, Home Retail Group, all these big companies. I'm like, what am I doing here? Anyway, Dutch Courage, pick up a glass of wine. Another glass of wine. Beers, four glasses of wine in before the main man steps off his off the podium and comes down to meet people. And it's heaving in this place. And just as he arrives to me, he puts out his hand, you know, throws it and goes, hi, I'm David Cameron. I'm like, I grabbed his hand, started shaking it frivolously, saying, yeah, I know who you are. You know, it's the whole thing of your 15 seconds of fame are passing you by, and I don't know.
10 seconds to make an impression, right?
By the time I kicked myself back into gear, he was going. He was going to walk away. At which point, I did something that I thought I was going to regret in my life, for the rest of my life. And I told you earlier, Sonia, I don't regret anything in my life. As he walked away, I grabbed his arm. And I'm like, oh, no.
At least it was his arm.
Yeah.
Well,
were
you going to say something else?
No. I grabbed his arm, turned him around, gave him a 45-second pitch of my life, basically, using a format called ISBA, ISBA, Issue Solution Barrier Action. I told him what the issue was. I told him what I wanted to do. I told him why I can't do it, because people didn't take me seriously. Mm. A few months went by, and then in July 2012, he wrote a letter supporting Youth Enterprise Life. And in October that year, we raised $250,000. We did Youth Enterprise Live. We impacted 18,500 young people. We gave away £750,000 in startup loan funding. We gave £150,000 for community-based projects. We gave 3,000 internship apprenticeship replacements and 300 jobs in 2 days. And it was just an idea that fermented on the fact that I wasn't an expert in events, I wasn't an expert in anything else, but I just knew that what we've got to learn to do in our lives is, and the one thing that I'll say to you is, nothing of greatness has ever been achieved without the help of others. And I think people need to understand that you can be good at one thing, but you don't have to be good at everything. And if you can find someone that can do the job you need done in 5 minutes, that takes you 5 weeks, these are the kind of results that you can get. Now, what this did for me, Sonia, was I didn't really realize until after I'd finished this event. We had a 4.2 million hashtag trend for youth, Yale 2012. We had people like Richard Branson tweeting. We had Tony Robbins tweeting. We got people talking outside of the country. Not only that, you've got young kids getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning in Newcastle.
Hey, where I'm from, great place.
Getting on a coach to come to London to this event, okay? I got George Michael back then having his concert after we finish upstairs, and they said, can we put this big banner for George? I'm like, no, it's my show, basically. But the point of it is I got to the end of this. This event almost killed me in the fact of putting it all together. There were lots of challenges, even to bad contract negotiations that my team had done, which I had to then think about, how am I going to pay for the show before the show's going to starting off, etc. But we got there. We got past the show. We delivered everything. And then I got a letter summoning me back to Downing Street. And this is where I thought, I'm going to get arrested. And strangely enough, I sat with Prime Minister Cameron then, and two things happened uniquely, which still shocked me to the day. Number one, he just said, you're quite disruptive, or you're a disruptor, which is why I have this label now. It's thank you to Mr.
I'll
DC.
I'll come back to the disruptive bit.
And the second thing he goes, I want you to do some stuff for us. And he offered me the opportunity to become a special advisor. And that changed a lot of things for me in my life. It meant that I could take my business in a completely different way. And I actually started to work with some very, very interesting characters, both here in the UK and pretty much all over the world. So since that kind of stuff, that's leap-jumped me where I've consulted the sixth president of Mauritius. I've worked with the Princess of Kuwait. I've worked with
royalty here in the UK. I've worked with sheikhs. I've worked, you know, from that kind of perspective. My day job consists today more of working with governments and ministries on how we're going to set up economic policies for their countries. So we do projects in places like Thailand. We're currently working in Vietnam and the Philippines. We're looking at, we've done stuff in Guatemala and Central America. And what it's allowed me to do is build an ecosystem around me. Today, I have a business, but I also have a big family. And this is that one thing that this one simple idea had. And this is the kind of thing, going back to that piece of litter that you had on the floor. Had I not picked that piece of litter up and put it in the bin, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today. And I think the message that I want to give people is that don't talk yourself out, talk yourself in. Because too many people talk themselves out. And I'm just a living example of a simple guy that has simple needs, that can do simple things, but in a very large scale now. So it's not just about following your dream and having passion. You've got to be...
So many people talk right about that these days. Find your dream, tap into your heart center and
feel it. Well, it wasn't my dream to
And this wasn't your dream.
I think for me, look, life has changed. I've changed. I told you that earlier. And I think for me, the word that describes most to me in my heart now is legacy.
Tell me about your legacy. I mean, it sounds like you've already got a huge legacy. where are you going to... Is there a place to take it now? I mean, it sounds like it's growing exponentially.
When I talk about legacy as... it's not like when I die, what do I want to be remembered for? I think when I go, I want to look back and say, what have I left behind? It's not about, for me, about how many people do we impact. I don't know. I can give you rough numbers, you know, because based on the number of people we work with through our training programs and what we do and the areas that we go into. But I know that there is a secondary, tertiary, and even a level 4 and 5 in the role of impact, you know, whether it's a show like this where I come in and people watch this and then they take some wisdom from that and pass it forward. It could be 3 or 4 generations of people that have been connected to a message I've given. So it's never been about the volume. It's about the core message that I've left.
The impact.
So whether it's 1 or 1 billion, it doesn't matter to me. The most important thing is, while I still have a chance, I've got to do this. Because for me, that's important to my legacy. You know, so I built my business not in a way even to give it to my kids. I've said to them, I'm sorry, but you don't get a chance.
You've got to do it yourself, right?
Yeah, when I go, it's going with me, basically. But I think this is what's changing in me, and this means that I have to pivot again, and this means that I have to now come back out into the market as a very different person doing very different things. So gone are the days where I used to procure a project in a college to try and help 30 young kids. We still do that. Today, I work with people who are going to invest into the, you know, hundreds of millions of people. And for me, it's not being the epicenter of it. It's just being part of that journey. That's what inspires me the most.
You mentioned the word disruptor. And the reason I wanted to come back to that is everyone at the moment who wants to be an entrepreneur wants to disrupt something. And I talk about interviewing disruptors, that word has got used and abused.
It sure has.
What does disruptor mean to you?
So there are 3 principal rules in being disruptive or being a disruptor. The first is that you have to challenge convention. The second is create imbalance. And the third is keep taking action. Most people will fail at one of those 3. So they could keep taking action, they could create imbalance, but if they haven't challenged convention, it won't work, and vice versa across all the paradigms of that. But if I was to give you a quick analogy, anything that can be disruptive, as long as it creates a negative and positive output. Most people that talk about being disruptive are trying to only be positive disruptors, but you cannot, you can't do it in one side. So it's like, if I ask you to clap your hand, you need 2 hands to clap. You can't clap with one in that respect. And if you can, you're not going to make a loud enough noise. And so this is the kind of thing, I come at this from different areas. In some places I'm all about just challenging the convention. Because I can say to you, there is more than one answer to any one question. Okay, if I asked you to give me a permutation, a mathematical permutation to the number 9, you may say 7 plus 2, I say 8 minus 1. Mm. we're both right, we just come at it different ways. So challenging convention is very much all about, it's not just about taking what's been done and trying to rile against it. It's to understand that you don't have to do things the same way everyone else has. And just because it worked for them, it doesn't mean it's going to work for you. And that's what challenge convention is all about. When you challenge your own convention and your own rules, what tends to happen is you start doing things differently, and that's where the imbalance comes. Some people like you and some people don't. Believe me, I've been in a boxing ring with Gary Vaynerchuk, for example, where we weren't boxing.
No, presumably not.
Where I've given a talk, and you know, people from the fitness industry are there, and I'm not exactly as you call fit, but it's more of a situation where my story doesn't resonate in all these particular ways. That's okay. I don't mind. In fact, I want more people to take my challenging convention negatively than positive. Why? Because that's where you fear your change. But you have to keep going. People don't keep going. As soon as they get a little bit of negativity, if they get a little bit of undermining question, they start to question the integrity of what they're doing.
And they feel a failure, perhaps?
They do. They feel a failure. Not in the failure of the result, the failure of being able to convince everyone. You see, we live in an environment and a society and a world of instant gratification and asking everyone for permission. I've got people on my Facebook right now who are asking me permission. And I'm like, why are you asking me permission? If you want to do it, you go and do it. Do you know what? I'm going to write this post, and every 3 seconds, I'm going to keep looking at it, see how many people have liked it, or commented it.
Yes.
And if I don't get past this little imaginary number in my head, it's a failure. Most people aren't disruptors, they're being disrupted, because what happens is they think they're going out to challenge convention, they think they're creating an imbalance, but they stop taking continued action. And eventually, what happens with this is you become the disrupted rather than the disruptor.
Sure.
It's just the same, it's the same connotation as if I threw a rock into a pond. The rock has disrupted the surface of the water. The rock's fallen to the bottom. It's disrupted the water going up and down. That's your negative and positive. But eventually, over time, the water brings back to its natural state at the top. But what it leaves is ripples. So if you are not prepared to deal with the positive and negative, you're never going to get to ripples. It's only when you get to ripple that it gets bigger and bigger and it hits the surface of the banks.
Yeah.
So most people want to create that ripple of disruption, and it's not that they don't know how to, they just give up before.
They don't want the shit that comes with it, basically.
Truth. Absolute truth. So being disruptive or being a disruptor or doing something disruptive requires those three things. And if you are claiming to it, by all means, great. I'm happy for you, but be honest to yourself, you know, because even I am not, I got told I'm a disruptor. I didn't say I am a disruptor. Now I just say I'm a chief disruptor, because I go around and I find, okay, one of these three things are going wrong in you or in your business. So I challenge the conventions of everything all the time. I love turning things upside down, shaking it and seeing what falls out. I like creating imbalance, because if I have a room of everyone that nods yes at me, I could just get the Churchill dogs and that will do it for me. I don't need all these other people to do that. I don't want people to love me. I want people to challenge me, you know, because that means I grow, you grow, we grow in that kind of sense. And what, you know, when we talk about failure is most of anything else. I'll tell you what failure is. Failure is the gap between your expectation and your delivery. Either you're expecting too much, too high, too quick, and you're not delivering to it, okay? Or you don't know how to expect or what to expect, and you just go out blind delivery. And the secret to this is there are two ways to overcome failure. Learn and grow by doing something more than you were doing yesterday. At the end of the day, you're not going to get fit if you don't go to the gym.
Right? Yeah, well, you've got to fail. It's muscle. You lift a weight. Basically, your muscle has to go to failure for it to grow. It's the only way it can grow is by taking something to failure.
Exactly. And the next thing is you've got to reduce and manage your expectation. So if you manage your expectation down and you increase your activity, you'll slowly reduce the gap of failure, which means, as they say to you, failure is a part of success. It's on the journey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, there's only two real things. So why do people fail? Because they put too much
expectation
and didn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And that's where accountability comes in. So one of the biggest things about turning failures to success is accountability, because as humans, we want to be connected. As humans, we want to help others. You know, the amount of people in the coaching and the personal development space, they want to connect with people, even if they haven't got the experience. I've had a 26-year-old and a 32-year-old pitch me life coaching, and I'm like, really?
I'm an accredited coach, and when I first thought I'd go down this journey, you know, I had 20-year-olds. I remember being at a party talking to them, saying, "Oh yeah, I'm a life coach." I'm like, "How can you be a life coach? I didn't even know what, have a life. I haven't lived, I've just left school or whatever."
The expectations are too high, and no matter how much they try on delivery, it's not going to work. Which means that a lot of people change the flavor of what they're in the business of, rather than keep to that consistency of what they're true to. And the thing with this is that you've got to become accountable.
Do you believe in having a coach or a mentor?
Yes.
Different, obviously.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, you should have both, and coaching comes before mentoring. You know, the whole thing of empowering someone right the way through to directing them. If they don't want to be led, you're not going to be able to get them there in that respect. But accountability is the biggest thing. Too many people shy away from not their responsibilities, their accountability. So accepting that their expectations are high. They don't change them. So it's not like they're not learning anything from their failure. They just don't even sit down number one and say, "Yeah, I got that wrong." They're like, "Oh, it's someone else. It wasn't the right time.
I'm not taking responsibility.
It was, I didn't have the right tool to do this." Or there's always a reason other than you. But it comes down to you. It's your life, your responsibility. I picked up that piece of litter, I put it in the bin, it took me to where I am. People resent me, people love me. It's not my job. My job is to keep doing what I'm doing. If I'm creating negativity, that means I'm disrupting. If I don't create negativity, that means that all I'm doing is approaching the task the way that people feel I should. And that's not good enough for me.
If someone wants to set up a business tomorrow and they came to you and asked you for some advice, and they wanted a mentor or a coach, what would you say they should look for in that person?
So I'm going to answer the question in two ways. The first thing is, what is it that they should be looking for? Is they should be looking for someone who's very experienced in what they want to grow into. It's no point having someone who hasn't experienced or understand what you do to be able to coach or mentor you in that particular environment. But the flip side of this is when people come to us, we don't look to just take on their business. We want to know if we're right for them.
Yes.
In that way. I need to understand that we can actually help you or not. There's too much of this kind of human connectivity, "I can help you," because it's actually... Why has this industry gone the way it has? It's because a lot of people are feeling good about themselves because they can give back to someone else. But actually what they don't know is the hypocrisy of the stuff that they shovel down to people could actually be changing the other person's life for the worse. And it was one of the things I said to Gary when I met him backstage. I went to Gary and I said, "I love the stuff that you do." I go, "But I have a bee in my bonnet about the way you do it." And he says, "What's that?" I said, "You can inspire people to get up and go to the gym at 4 o'clock. Why?" And he goes, "Why are people going to the gym?" You said, you keep saying about hustle and grind, all of these words, right? It means working hard and being committed. But I said, you're inspiring people to do something, but you're not telling them how to do it. And I said, "This is the biggest problem you have." I go, "Because I'm a work smart, not hard kind of guy."
Yeah, absolutely agree. Completely.
Yeah, and it's kind of a situation of saying, "Look, I'm not cursing you or anything, but, and you don't have to take my advice, it's just an opinion. But my point of it is that if you're going to go out and have responsibility of pulling people to a particular thing, understand as a coach or a mentor," which he is, even if he's not doing it directly.
Of course he is, he's talking about
He is changing people's lives. But most people only see what they change for the greater good. What about the ones that you change for bad? The amount of business owners come to us saying, "I've lost all my money, I've pissed it all away on crap coaching and all of this, I've got nothing and I need you to turn my business around." Yeah. And we have to sit here and say, "Okay, we'll help you turn it around, but we won't take a payment because we can't until we've achieved the result. The amount of people that are out there right now who are even watching this right now and say, yeah, I made a mistake, but are they ready to account for it from inside? Because when we take you on, we will make you feel like shit at first, because we want to get all that crap out of you so you're ready. You're ready to rise.
Great words. Ketan, we are literally coming towards the end of the interview, and I feel like I've got so many more questions. We're going to have another interview, part two.
Yeah,
but my final question, Ketan, and I ask this to all my guests, is if you were to write a message in a bottle for future generations to find, what would that message be?
It's just like what I would write to my 13, 14, 15-year-old self, which is be true to yourself. Don't take no for an answer. There's more than one answer to any one question. And if life gives you lemons, go and make lemonade.
Ketan, thank you so much for being a guest on my show. Hope you enjoyed the show. Remember, there's a new interview out every Monday. So hit subscribe and like, and you'll get it straight into your inbox.